You're watching Notepad. I'm your host, Ibrahim Sani. Thanks for joining us for this evening. I think we want to talk a little bit more about GLC reforms, how we can get it done. And of course, joining us this evening is Tricia Yeo of Ideas. Tricia, the reformation of the GLCs is important, but first, let's help try to understand the contextualization of it. How do we classify or reclassify what it constitutes to be a GLC?
Sure. Thank you for addressing this very important issue. Ideas has been working on GLCs for a number of years now. So first, I think we need to distinguish between government-linked investment companies and government-linked companies. So the GLICs are the ones that are holding the shares within other companies, right? So the GLICs would be like PNB, like Minister of Finance Incorporated, like the your EPF. So those would be GLICs. And then you also have wholly owned government companies. So wholly owned government companies are companies that are 100% under, say, the Ministry of Finance. Ministry of Finance has the most number of these such companies. And then you also have companies that the government has only a small shareholding in, and you also there are different ways to slice the pie, right? So I've talked about the GLICs and the GLCs, and then I've talked about wholly owned government companies and partially owned, where you have the government has a small percentage or a majority shareholding. So under the Ministry of Finance alone. We've gone through the research and the companies in which MOF Inc. has a majority ownership, and MOF Inc. has a majority ownership within 69 different companies. So another way of slicing the pie of distinguishing between these companies would be whether they are set up by statute. So these would be statutory bodies. And in Malaysia itself, we have 136 statutory companies. Statutory bodies, because they are set up by way of enactment. And this can range from agriculture-related ones to, you know, state-based ones. And finally, between statutory bodies and companies. So if the companies are set up by way of Companies Commission of Malaysia, that means that they have the same rights as any other company would have. And another way of slicing the pie, and I'm sorry for giving so many different definitions, because I think it's important to know the difference between GLCs. Sometimes we just lump them all together and talk about GLCs as if they were all the same, but they are not. There's also a difference between the federal bodies and the state bodies. Most of the conversation usually centers on federal bodies because we know more about them, but less about the state bodies because we know very little about them. And finally, a distinction between the publicly listed companies and the ones that are not. So publicly listed companies will have a lot more stringent requirements that they need to adhere to because they are subject to, for example, a Securities Commission rules. They also have Bursa Malaysia, and they have basically the public shareholding, the interests of the public at large, whereas you have hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands. By the way, we don't know how many GLCs our country actually has because there isn't a central body that keeps monitoring and tracking these companies. We've got hundreds of smaller companies in which government has a share of or a percentage ownership in these. And I would say that we don't really know how the performance of these hundreds of companies are. So just to give an example of naming, you know, I think the categorization can be a little bit complicated. So there's a difference between, say, a large GLC like Petronas, and a smaller GLC or a statutory body like Kajora, or there are many other statutory bodies that are governed by different ministries, which are not publicly listed, and therefore we don't have enough information about them. So I think that's just a starting point to unpack what we mean by GLCs. Another term that sometimes is used is called the state-owned enterprises, SOEs. SOEs are the international term that is used to refer to anything that is fully state-owned. So, yeah, we could say state-owned would be like the fully owned ones, and then GLCs would be the ones that the government has a shareholding in.
Right. So, you know, when somebody says SOE, the names that would come to mind would be Temasek, for instance, in Singapore, Khazanah. And I think that is the clear-cut differentiating factor here, because when we talk about GLCs, at least in my circles, we normally associate companies that governments have shareholding in, say, for instance, CIMB or Maybank or Sime Darby and so on. I think the conversation that needs to be had is on these statutory bodies that you speak of, the bodies that are associated with ministries, and that of under Ministry of Finance Incorporated. In fact, when Professor Terence Gomez of UM wrote that book, rather much talked about book, MOF Inc., about two, three years ago, it did spark a lot of conversation in terms of the classification of these companies. And you're right. We are just talking about the federal level only most of the time. In fact, in this interview, most of our conversation between you and me will be about federal level as well. Largely because not much coverage has been given to state, and we have a lot of states, and their kind of oversight is actually quite murky. With this in mind, do you feel that there is a need for us to reform GLCs? And of course, the conversation should be on whether or not there is a political will to carry out these kind of reforms.
Yes, I think for years we've been talking about the need to reform. But let me tell you why it's important to reform. By the way, that book that you mentioned, Minister of Finance Incorporated, that was actually published and supported by IDEAS. So we were very much at the forefront of pushing for this discussion to take place. GLCs are public, right? When you have any kind of shareholding of government, what that means is that it represents public funds. So if there are public funds involved in any of these companies, whether it's fully owned or whether it's partially owned by some percentage, what it means is the government actually has a responsibility to the public as to how these are performing. So if they're not performing well, then what happens time and again is that they will be bailed out or perhaps given financial aid. And what that means is that the public, by way of paying taxes, is actually subsidizing an inefficiently run company. So that's one. Number two, the question about the objective of and the purpose of the GLC emerges as well. So, you know, whether or not the GLC should be in existence or whether government should have a role to play in investing in this particular company emerges. Many times we see that the government will invest in a company that eventually crowds out the private sector. So while SMEs, you know, well-meaning, even Bumiputra SMEs are coming into the scene, trying to compete and say win tenders and so on, if they are crowded out from the market because there's a presence of a GLC, which has a lot of funding, has a lot of preferential treatment, a lot of terms, perhaps like loans that are unsecured and interest-free. So all this provides an unfair advantage to the GLC, therefore crowding out the SME. So what does that actually mean for the market and the flourishing of private investment? So what IDEAS has done is, and we actually have not published this, so I hope that we can also get feedback from the public, is we're asking a question, when should the GLC be allowed to exist? Or rather, when should government still make the decision to stay investing into that particular company? And I think the main central question would be, is there a strategic need for the government to be in that particular enterprise? And if there is no strategic need, then the next question is, can the shares actually be divested? Because we understand that there are some times where, you know, if the government tries to divest shares, and this has been attempted before. I have also heard this line from government, by the way, that they try to divest, but there's no company that wants to take it up. So if it cannot be divested successfully or immediately, then we can hold on, but do a periodic review from time to time. If it can be divested, then yes, let's go completely commercial. And what do we mean by strategic as well? When we say strategic, we ask three questions, right? So is the company involved in the business of, say, development financing, so DFIs. This is where you have your SME bank, you know, that kind of providing development financial assistance to the companies that need it, SMEs perhaps, recapitalization. So that's one category. The second category is if there's a strategic need for economic development. A lot of GLCs were formed in the 1970s and 80s on the premise of economic development, developing the economy not just at the federal level, but at the state level. So a lot of the state economic development corporations, the SEDCs, were set up during that time in the 70s, 80s. And then finally, the third criteria would be, is there a strategic need in providing infrastructure and public services to the country? So public services, you know, you can imagine that sometimes companies cannot be very competitive. So if it's a legal monopoly, then maybe we hold it for a moment because the government can produce the funds necessary. So say providing, I think that there will be discussion over electricity, for example, that is a rather natural monopoly. And is it the only provider of service? If it is not the only provider of service, then we can put some measures in place to improve governance. If it is the only provider of service, then we also can hold and have a periodic review. So I think a more systematic way of analyzing the treatment of government role in business can actually take place. And we don't see this happening right now. Like, we don't see the systematic analysis step by step, this sort of filtration process into determining which sectors they should be in existence and which sectors they should not. And I highly encourage government to do this.
Yeah, I don't see why the government wants to do this, though. This is the simplest outlet for them to carry out favors with their friends. This is also an ability. This is an ability for them to actually pull leverage amongst their political enemies. I don't know why government would be interested in reforming these GLCs. But the impetus is on us, as you rightfully said. These are public funds. These are still public officials that need to be held into account. You guys have been saying, ideas have been saying again and again about performative efficiency and how we need to hold these parties to a higher standard of accountability. You did give a clear indication of how to measure whether or not somebody, whether or not government should be in business. That three items: if there's no economic role, if there's no public service, if there's no recapitalization of assets, they shouldn't be in these kind of items, but they still do. And I think that's where the gem is. Knowing this, what would be some of the ideas that ideas have when it comes to untangling this particular logjam?
So a review of GLCs would be really necessary because, like I said earlier, we don't know the number and the function. So we actually don't have a landscape view of all the different GLCs and therefore, importantly, the financial burden that the government has to bear as well on the back of, say, GLC debt or contingent liabilities, because these are the liabilities that government carries, right? And some of them are not recorded in the budget books. So I think having an accurate picture of how everything fits together, that's really important. Then you can see, okay, are some sectors like overrepresented? What's the weight and what's the fat, right? Like, where's the fat in which of these sectors? So having that overview, that review is I would say, really of utmost importance. And then I think having an act that provides for governance of these GLCs that we have already done the homework on in providing a review on would be important. So in the past, when Malaysia was negotiating to be part of the TPPA, the understanding was because we have so many GLCs, the negotiation with the other countries was that we would actually emerge with an SOE Governance Act, a State-Owned Enterprises Governance Act, SOGA. And of course, we know the TPPA fell through. But having said that, Malaysia is right now negotiating to be part of the CPTPP. So I would be very interested in whether this is part of the works, whether the SOE Governance Act will be included in this process. And if so, then it's also a second very good step. The third step would be, I think, political appointments. And this is something that many, many civil society and think tanks and academics have already talked about. So it's sort of like, you know, we've waxed lyrical about it and doesn't quite need the repetition. But because it needs to be part of the reform agenda, I'm going to talk about it again. We know that the boards of GLCs are a place where the politicians actually use to place their loyalists or even losers, right? So people who have not actually emerged as victors in an election but still can get rewards within GLCs because the board directorship fees can be quite lucrative and can also be a very important source of political funding, right? Let's face it, a lot of the donations come through the GLCs, whether in kind or in money terms. So the conflict of interest is clear. I think the first thing is to get rid of these political appointments, because what is the objective here? The objective is to make sure that the GLCs are performing well, are running efficiently, because then there can be sufficient returns that can accrue back to the country, and the country can use those funds for development purposes, for education, for health, you know, like building more schools, building more hospitals. And of course, like in a post-pandemic world, we will need this money. We will need these resources as we go through our economic recovery period. But going back to the political appointments, I think what I also said is that it's important to maybe address the low-hanging fruit first, because I don't see a time and place where the politicians will immediately get rid of political appointments in one fell swoop. What we can do is stagger it. And to do that, I would recommend removing political appointments for the chairman of the GLCs first. The chairman would be the ones who set direction of the companies. And it's really important because we cannot afford the chair to use or to enlist the GLCs for their own political purposes alone, and not think about the health, the financial health of the GLC in question. Later on, maybe you can talk about the political appointees of the directors within the board, but let's address the chair first. So I think those are three immediate steps that I could imagine being very important at the moment. There are a lot of more things that should be done. Oh, another additional one would be taking a page out of some countries who already have active SOEs. So we're not saying that SOEs and GLCs shouldn't exist at all. I think we are trying to look at a more analytical perspective, right? Which ones should be allowed to exist, which ones should not be. And having a centralized agency that records and monitors the performance of all of them would be very good. Thailand has that. China has that. So there are precedents that we can follow after.
Wouldn't MOF Incorporated be the most suited for this role?
It would be, because most of the imported GLCs do come under MOF Incorporated. However, I think we just want to recognize that there should be some independence as well, and perhaps some arm's length relationship, because many other ministries have their own GLCs. And if the MOF Incorporated is the one that is going to do that, we just don't know what kind of treatment the GLCs or SOEs under the MOF Incorporated portfolio might be given as opposed to the others. I think having an independent one might be a safer bet, so that all can be treated, well, equally, that's the ideal, but as close to equal as possible, I think would be the safe target.
Let's talk a little bit more about the assistance that normally is asked out of the GLCs. And if I recall, very recently we had this forum and you were talking about sometimes GLCs can be or even expected to assist governments in terms of crisis. And what is a crisis now if not for the assistance that they need currently? But you were mentioning about the timeline that is involved, that sometimes GLC's assistance is very much short term, that long term is actually very much under the purview of the government, that the onus is still on the government to develop systems, policies, laws, and perhaps an infrastructure framework for better, longer term kind of assistance to be or to be created. Where do we stand when it comes to the long-term planning for the government in building these kind of infrastructure? Or are they still very much trying to solve or put out fires of the day?
Right. I think this is a really interesting question, because it kind of puts to question, again, like, what should the role of the GLC be? So I think I have two opinions of this. So on the one hand, I'll talk about what my belief is, and then I'll also talk about, like, you know, why perhaps that's not so relevant right now. So my natural positioning would be that GLCs should not be the primary body that is dependent upon to provide aid. And why I say that is because I think it is not long-term measure. they can only provide short-term measures, right? And they have certainly done that. So to the credit of the JLC and JLIC network, there's a JLC-JLIC disaster response network that has already provided a lot of medical and non-medical response and aid. So, you know, you've got all kinds of different ones like Celcom, Iskandar Investments, Sapura Energy, SP Setia, Farmaniaga, MRCB. They've all contributed like a lot of money to, and as well as medical relief to this particular disaster response network. So credit is due to them. However, so like there are gaps as well, given that they are providing money to a fund. So the gap would be, for example, I think East Malaysia actually has had insufficient aid. And you can't really blame the JLCs for not looking in that direction because that's not their mandate. So my point here is that if the JLCs are dependent upon to provide the aid as a primary contributor, then what happens is that there will be gaps, there will be blind spots that they are not able to capture looking at the entirety of the nation. So for example, like East Malaysia, right? So maybe it's because you're not getting the aid from JLCs that are Sabah and Sarawak based. The point here is that there will be blind spots because that's not their mandate to be nationally oriented. The government, however, is given the mandate to be nationally oriented, and therefore that should be the primary focus where they provide the long-term response. And importantly, for transparency and accountability of the books as well, it's very crucial that these funds or whatever that is currently being spent on, say, the pandemic or any kind of national crisis and emergency for that matter, has to be accounted for and recognized, because once you account for it, then it is accurately reflected in the government books that the government is taking on this much debt burden on behalf of the nation, and it can accurately reflect on our risk. So we can do proper risk assessment, risk mitigation, and this would not happen if it was the JLCs, because we're not really monitoring the wide expanse of JLCs and whether or not they will have, say, a hole in their books, which the government would be forced to step in to bail out and to save. And then who makes that decision about the bailing out process? Which JLC should be the one that is saved ultimately? So I think given that we are doing that right now, what's really important is that, you know, we've talked about exit strategy, exit plan for the pandemic. I think it's also important to have an exit strategy for the dependency on JLCs, because if this is allowed to continue, then there's several implications, right? That it means that government actually does not fully know the extent of what government itself is needed to carry the weight of. And secondly, like I said, it's not accounted for. So governments would need to consider how to support specific SOEs, given the best, and whether it's the best use of their limited resources. The aid needs to be very objective to minimize the market distortions and the exit policies, as I mentioned earlier. But so that's the first half of my answer. The second half of my answer is, my first half is that ideally speaking, they should not be dependent upon. But the second half of my answer is that, let's face it, we do have this network and the government has referred to it time and time again, referring to an ecosystem. So given the wide expanse of our ecosystem, I think it is a good idea to use them at this moment. But in planning ahead for long-term crises, we should be very wary of and very careful of depending too heavily on the ecosystem to provide aid. And so IDEAS has done the analysis as well. We've calculated the percentage, and I think we've calculated that almost 48 or 50% of the government stimulus packages that it has announced right over the last year, including I don't think we've included the recent Permacaster Plus because there was not enough time. But up to the point before this recent package, close to 50% of the assistance is funded by the ecosystem. Whether it is fully ecosystem, so ecosystem would be JLCs, or partially ecosystem plus government, or ecosystem plus private sector. So what we're saying is half of the aid is actually coming to us from GLCs. Is this sustainable? Is this healthy? Is this something that we want for the future? I think that it actually can be quite dangerous, to be honest, but we have it right now. We can use it, but we should really wean ourselves off getting aid from the GLC ecosystem.
Before we part, I want to ask you some of the things that IDIS is publishing or has published that might draw some attention for the viewers right now. What would be some of the ideas that you guys have done when it comes to this issue?
Yeah, so IDIS has a long history of working on GLCs. Please go on our website. We've created this new nice filter system now, so you can look at all the past GLC-related policy papers. The most recent one was we were looking at how GLCs, like what's the intersection between GLCs and the government or the country fulfilling the SPV, the Shared Prosperity Vision. So we looked at the number of GLCs that are supposed to aim at aiding Bumiputra community in Malaysia and whether or not we have fallen short of those targets. Another one that we are going to release soon, hopefully, is actually about this structuring and streamlining where it is GLC, how GLC should be defined and what I talked about earlier, like whether they're strategic or not. Separately, we are doing a project that we hopefully will launch a later part of this year where we will be putting up a GLC appointments tracker on a website and looking at the political appointments, or not just political, but basically appointments generally of the major GLCs and statutory bodies. So this is all part of the ongoing work of GLCs. And just go to the website. I mean, you would probably be able to find like at least 8 to 10 policy papers on the subject.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. That was Tricia Yeo, the CEO of IDIS, joining us this evening to talk about the reform of GLCs. If you missed any part of this interview, just head on to astroawani.com, look for IDIS or look for GLCs. I'm sure a lot of items like these can be popped up there as well. Until then, thanks very much for watching and catch you in the next one.